Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Listen.
Sound check.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. How do you know when a relationship might have a future or not? I mean, if you're really in love, you might think you can put up with almost anything. But what happens when the apple of your eye turns out to be a fan of the Electric Prunes, and you're a fan of Mozart? Or one of you likes Michael Jackson and the other one likes Sean Lennon? Actually, that one will work out just fine, because Sean's new duo, Mystical Weapons, will be here to play for us in just a bit, and we'll get a review of a major new Michael Jackson biography. But mostly, musical differences can be an early warning sign of trouble ahead. So one of the first dates I took my wife on was to see David Bowie at Madison Square Garden. This was important because I'd gotten a glimpse of her paltry collection of aging pop records, and I was getting kind of worried. Fortunately, she loved the Bowie concert. All right, I thought, full speed ahead. She has musical taste after all. Or she was just saying that, but she's really into being out with me. Either way, I win. A third possibility, that she was just really into Bowie because Bowie was hot, did not occur to me. Until now. Anyway, musical differences can be a red light on a relationship. So says Faith Saley, a regular part of our Soundcheck bullpen and contributor to CBS Sunday Morning. And yes, there is a story there. You can read Faith's blog post about this on our website, soundcheck.org. Faith, welcome back.
Hi, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. So this idea of musical red lights, explain what you mean by that.
Well,
and perhaps why you've even been thinking of it.
Okay. Well, you know, when you're in a relationship, usually it's early on, maybe you're a little ways in, and you find out something about your significant other that, you know, he says that The Fountainhead and Catcher in the Rye are the best books that were ever written, or I love Jay Leno, right? Or or I went on a blind date with a guy who had lived in New York for years, had never seen a show. And they said, oh, wait a minute. One time I saw that play about the French Revolution. And I sort of, I didn't want it to be true. But I said, do you mean the musical Les Miserables? Yeah, that one. And those are red lights, right? And in retrospect, I think those red lights get redder. When you think back, you're like, oh, I should have known. So do you remember that song? It was everywhere in 2003. It was White Flag. By Dido. Couldn't escape it.
You know who hated that song? My then seven-year-old daughter. Hated.
A seven-year-old?
Hated that song.
I can't imagine that she grasped the lyrics.
I don't imagine. I'm not sure I grasped the lyrics.
Well, I did, in retrospect. So I remember. So I'm divorced. I am happily married to somebody else. This is 2005. My then-fiancé, that would be my first husband, and I had flown to Edinburgh, where we were planning our wedding. That's where we got married. I remember we were getting in the taxi from the Edinburgh airport, and Dido was playing, and it was White Flag. And he said, oh, I love this song. And I said, you do? And he said, yeah, listen to the lyrics. This woman is so in love. She'll always be in love with him. She knows she's screwed everything up. She'll never get over him. And he said, that's love. That's so feminine. And I just thought, that's
ew.
At the time it felt like even the word feminine felt really weird, like, oh, that's an idealistic feminine kind of love, because he wasn't saying if you and I ever broke up, I'd love you forever. And so that felt weird. And then three years later we were separated. He wanted to get a divorce. I did everything I could to save that relationship. But
did you sing White Flags?
I basically did, John. I'm such a I can't use the word
right,
on the radio.
Okay.
So
I think we know where you're going.
But it was his embrace of the lyrics and the meaning of it that he thought that was love, that was feminine love. I should have known.
I know you think that I shouldn't still love you. I'll tell you that.
But I will go down with this
shit. And I won't put the song is White Flag from the artist Dido.
Gets slower every time you hear it. I'm waving my white flag, Dido, please stop singing.
So Faith Salley with us here in the Soundcheck studio and talking about musical red lights. And so when your now ex-husband said that he really, really loved that song, that was a warning sign.
Yeah.
Your story goes a little deeper perhaps than a lot of the other, but when you know, when you Facebooked about this, when we put a call out to our listeners, we got
so many responses.
So many
Apparently,
people have had
Steely
this.
Steely Dan is a big red light for people, by the way. I've got several about that.
Well, now this would be a good time for us to bring in our old friend Daniel Levitin, the neuroscientist, who is also a musician and a best-selling author. Dan's on the line with us, the lucky devil from the Sundance Festival. Hi, Dan.
Hi, John. How are you? Hi, Faith. Boy, after that confessional of yours, Faith, I want to ask just one question. Tell me more about your mother.
She was lovely. It's all my fault.
Dan, I mean, how much does our taste in music say about who we are as people? Is it really a red flag if you find yourself hating a song that your partner loves?
Well, it can be. And, you know, I'll start with my collaborator, Jason Renfro, did a study a few years ago where he found that people use music to communicate information about their personalities to others. He set up an experiment where the task was for strangers to get to know each other. And in a context where these individuals were completely free to talk about anything they wanted, they tended to talk about music.
Hmm.
Now, he had a set of observers watching this interaction, and the neutral observers of the conversation were actually pretty accurate at forming impressions of those people's personalities by what music they like. So we're already engaged in this act of self-disclosure when we're discussing music, and I think a natural extension of that is, well, the music we like does tell us and our other people in our lives something about our personalities.
Now, what does that say about kind of stereotyping? You know, we stereotype the rap fans as being kind of, you know, hardcore,
aggressive.
Streetwise, and yeah, aggressive and violent. We characterize, you know, fans of progressive rock or classical music as the nerdy types. I mean, do those sort of categories break down, or did this experiment actually suggest there's something to that?
Well, in Jason's experiment, it did suggest there's something to it. Now, these aren't perfect correlations. You can't predict perfectly.
Yeah.
But you can go farther than if you knew nothing about the person's musical taste. So, for example, a quality like extroversion, people in the experiment had to predict who was extroverted. Extroversion tended to relate to the amount of energy and enthusiasm in a particular piece of music. And then you look at things like values. If a person placed high values on national security,
mm-hmm.
they tended to like country music.
I'm not surprised.
That's so
weird.
If
they placed a high lifestyle value on having an exciting life, they tended to like metal.
Really? So, you know, when Faith talks about being put off a little bit by her now ex-husband's love of that Dido song that we hear, was on some neurological or possibly evolutionary level? Was there something in her brain that was kind of reacting, you know, this is a different sort of person from the type of person I usually like?
Well, I think there's two things here. One of them is very practical, which is it's effectively one person saying to the other, you don't like my friends,
mm.
right? I mean, we develop these very personal relationships with the music that we like and the musicians that make it, we imagine that we have a personal relationship with the music because it moves us so quietly and internally. It sets up feelings in us that we don't usually talk about and that we don't usually have with others that are not intimate with us, right?
Right.
It makes you vulnerable when you say, I love this song, in a way, right, Dan?
It does. The effect that the music has on you is one that comes through vulnerability. You're opening yourself up to very powerful emotions. So, in effect, one partner saying to the other, you don't like my friends, and this leads to some sense that, well, maybe we have incompatible interests. It's not just like rooting for opposite football teams.
Yeah, yeah.
Because music is more personal. What are we going to do when we're sitting around having a nice dinner? Are you going to want to listen to that? Are you going to want to listen to Nicki Minaj while I want to hear Kelly Clarkson? Or am I going to want to listen to Brad Paisley and you're going to want to listen to Chief Keef?
Well, it's we're talking about musical red lights. Faith Saley brought the subject up, CBS Sunday Morning contributor, member of our Soundcheck bullpen. Daniel Levitin, the neuroscientist, helping to explain why this actually is something that you will feel pretty deeply, as many of you know. In fact, one of our listeners, Gary, here in New York, is joining us on the line. Hi, Gary.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. So you've had an experience with one of these musical red lights?
Yeah, I actually have. It was probably a couple years after I moved to New York, and, you know, I was getting my bearings, and, you know, I met someone that I thought we shared some interesting connections. About a couple months into our relationship, we were starting to get serious. We had taken a vacation together, I remember there was an afternoon where, I mean, I can picture it in my head. This girl was dancing around to a Counting Crows song.
It's down at the New Amsterdam. Stared at this yellow-haired girl. Mr. Jones strikes up a conversation with a black-haired flamenco dance. You know she danced.
Okay, so we're at the point in your story where you're possibly soon-to-be live-in girlfriend is dancing around to Counting Crows, and your response is what?
It was pretty visceral. I mean, I think I hit it pretty well at the time. I think, you know, I don't think I joined in on the dancing, but, you know, as I was about to sort of give her my explanation as to why I take great offense to Counting Crows, I was a musician, and one of the things that I really hate with certain bands is don't reference other bands in your songs. It's like one of my big no-nos. She expressed how much these songs spoke to her, specifically Mr. Jones. I remember it being a big red flag for me and thinking, gosh, you know, this could be a real big problem.
Counting Crows was just a bridge too far for you.
It pretty much, I think it just put up, it just opened my eyes a little bit, and I was on guard.
Did you say, it's not you, it's not me, it's Counting Crows, it's Mr. Jones.
And yeah. Gary, it's a tale that I guess has played out many times, because we have other listeners leaving comments and stuff that I want to get to, but thanks for sharing your story. We're talking about these warning signs, these musical red lights, with Faith Saley, CBS Sunday Morning contributor, member of the Soundcheck bullpen, the neuroscientist and best-selling author Daniel Levitin with us on the phone. Dan, why music? Why not visual arts, literature, poetry? I mean, people
politics.
Do argue about those things, but, not, you know, in terms of the arts, why is it music that kind of rips us apart?
Well, yeah, I think as Faith pointed out at the top, it can be film and it can be literature, right? There's this whole aesthetic sense that we cultivate about what we like and what we don't like, and we want to be able to share that with our intimates, or at least we want them to value what we value. If they don't enjoy it, we want them to at least recognize our extremely good taste in liking it ourselves. But music does somehow seem to be more visceral, and I don't have a good answer for that, other than the experience of so many people that music just seems more personal,
yeah,
and to move us more deeply than painting and literature and film.
And don't you think that with music you can engage in it more? You can drag someone you love to see a painting that moves you, but with music you can hum it, you can sing it, you can play it in your car, you can say, hey, listen to this at any time.
Mm.
I think you're right, and there is a neurological story there, and that is that music is so highly structured because of the musical scale having only 12 notes. It's such a highly structured medium that our brains are pretty good at predicting what's going to come next, even in an unfamiliar piece of music. So on a moment-by-moment and note-by-note basis, the brain is more tightly coupled with the stimulus than we are with literature or with film or visual art.
Mm. Now, Faith, you put out this question about musical red lights to your followers on Facebook. And Allison wrote, I love this. Allison writes, I was on a blind date once, and the guy told me his favorite musician was Jewel. I made him repeat it like 4 times. I thought maybe I was mishearing him. What dude says his favorite artist is Jewel? I was on the fence about him, and that pushed me off. no go to a second date.
You're always brilliant in the morning, smoking your cigarettes and talking over coffee. Your philosophy's an art, Baroque moved you, you loved Mozart, and you'd speak of your loved ones as I clumsily strummed my guitar.
That's a little bit of Foolish Games,
you know,
from Jewel.
You know what's interesting in that song, in the lyrics, it's a love song, and she's referencing You Love Mozart.
I was just going to ask Dan this question. Dan, I mean, a lot of the examples we've been talking about so far, as disparate as they are all in the world of popular vernacular music. If you add classical music to the mix, one person likes, you know, Brahms and Beethoven and Bach, and another person likes Lady Gaga. Will they, is that just so far apart that it's easier to find, I guess what I'm asking is, you know, when they're so far apart, is it as big a problem as if, for example, one person likes Mozart and the other likes Wagner and the two hate each other's choices?
Well, you know, at that point, they may as well just throw in the towel and decide they're going to go to concerts separately, right?
I guess that's true. And, you know, on a purely practical level, I guess another reason why music can be such a deal breaker is, you know, you read a book by yourself, you can go to films by yourself, you can watch, you know, TV by yourself, but you put a record on, even in the day of iPods. If you're driving with your significant other in the car, who's got control of the radio, the CD player?
And
I mean, it really is sort of forcing your taste on the other person.
And you know, I keep going here because I have a baby, but when you have kids, you're also thinking, who gets to control what music's in the house? What is my child, going to grow up listening to the Beatles or the soundtrack to Hair? Well, I guess they're not that different.
Or become a Scientologist.
Exactly. Wait, what do Scientologists listen to?
Well, I mean, it's almost that extreme, right? It's as though there's this religious indoctrination. Are you going to raise your kids on this religion or that?
Well, now, here's a question about, there are lots of people out there probably thinking, well, gee, my spouse, my partner hates my music, and I hate his or her music, and yet we get along fine. So there is room for compromise somehow, isn't there?
Well, sure there is. And some people are more open to being in a committed relationship with incompatible interests. I mean, there's even a term for this. They're called married singles. They're people who go about their life in a largely single, you know, one plays tennis, the other plays golf. One of them listens to Mozart, the other listens to Linkin Park, and they come together for family activities, but they're living, coexisting in the same household, effectively as singles.
And
right.
You can have
so
a
one's,
healthy
a, one's
respect.
A Democratic Yankee fan, and the other's a Republican Red Sox
right.
fan.
And you can have a healthy respect.
I really don't see how that would work, but okay.
You know, the other night, I actually took my husband to Lynyrd Skynyrd, and they were playing, before Lynyrd Skynyrd came on, they were playing music, and I turned to him and I said, this song sounds familiar, what is this? And his eyes got so big and then so weary, and he said, honey, this is called Kashmir by Led Zeppelin. And I said, oh yeah, I've heard this song. And instead of taking off his wedding ring, he sort of gave me a kiss on the forehead. So there you go, right?
All right, so you he has found a way to live
to love
in,
me anyway.
In your Led Zeppelin-less world.
Yes.
We've been speaking with Faith Thaly, CBS Sunday Morning contributor, a member of our Soundcheck bullpen, and Daniel Levitin, the neuroscientist and musician and best-selling author. I'm going to give the last word to Todd Wilson. This is another of the Facebook responses to this idea of musical red flags. Todd writes, I hate Billy Joel. Hate Billy Joel. Six A's there. My wife, however, is a big fan. We've made it work, 11 years and counting, but she knows it's like Ebola kryptonite for me and wields it like a mallet. All right, Todd. Finding a way to make it work. Good for you. Dan, Faye, thank you both for joining us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't go changing to try and please me. You never let me down before. Mm-hmm. Don't imagine you're too familiar, and I don't see you
more. I would not leave you in times of trouble. We never could have come this far. I took the good times, I'll take the bad times, I'll take you just the way you are.
Listeners, tell us about your experience with musical red lights. Have they given you momentary pause or maybe even brought a whole relationship to a screeching halt? Give us a call at 866-939-1612 or leave a comment on our website, soundcheck.org.
Yo, bad business, 100 million. Wait, Mike says this should be a song about women. But then he said he don't know any women. I told him, yo, I know like 7 women. I know women, they like to go swimming. They like to drink tea, they like to think in the cool breeze. From the east on a beach or the west. Yo, women, they the best.
Ladies and gentlemen, we want you to join us in person at a taping of Soundcheck next Thursday afternoon, January 31st. Come and see a live performance from this rapper, Heems, formerly of the group Das Racist. He'll join us in the green space, and so will hip-hop fan Eddie Wong, who you may know as the owner of the New York restaurant Bauhaus and author of the new memoir Fresh Off the Boat. Come see a conversation with Eddie Wong and a performance by Heems on January 31st, 2 p.m. in the green space. For tickets, go to soundcheck.org. Up next, a new biography attempts to unearth new details about the life of Michael Jackson. We'll get a review. And later, well, we're not sure what's going to happen during a performance by Mystical Weapons. Even the band members don't know. The improvisational duo of Sean Lennon and Greg Saunier of Deerhoof join us to perform in the studio later on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The late King of Pop is the subject of a new biography called Untouchable, The Strange Life and Tragic Death of Michael Jackson. It was written by Randall Sullivan, a former Rolling Stone contributing editor, who also wrote about the murders of rap stars Notorious B.I.G. and Tupac Shakur. Sullivan's Michael Jackson biography runs to nearly 800 pages and purports to dig deeper into a life that has already been deeply analyzed. The music writer Bill Wyman reviewed Untouchable for The New Yorker and joins us to talk about it. He's in the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Hi, Bill.
Hi, John. How are you?
Good. So my first reaction to this 800-page tome is, does the world need another book about Michael Jackson?
Oh, absolutely. He actually has been written about very poorly over the years, I think. There's a pretty good earlier biography by J. Randy Tarabarelli that he'd kind of been involved with the Jacksons for many years going back, and it's a pretty good overview. I really like Sullivan's approach because he's much better with numbers. He knows the lawyers. He talks about the will and the estate and things like this. He's a very rigorous reporter, as we saw from his book Labyrinth, which was about the Biggie Smalls murder. So I was really looking forward to it and to some extent really enjoyed his actual work on the subject because I thought he was a serious person that wasn't approaching this as hagiography and talked about some of the uncomfortable issues.
Uh-huh. So what are some of the kind of the big stories that we either have not heard before or heard in a kind of bolderized fashion before?
Well, I mean, it's mostly the things we basically knew, but people didn't really ever talk about. And when he was interviewed, for the most part, didn't really ask him about it. His obvious drug addiction, the stuff, the changes to his physiognomy, and just his obvious growing eccentricity, weirdness, and final, which seems to me pretty plain case of mental illness that sort of put him on his downward spiral. So right there. Another thing people don't really talk about is the decline in his popularity. Most super-duper pooper stars, they have a really big record, and then their next record sells about half that, and the mm-hmm. next one sells half that, and the next one sells half that. And Jackson in the U.S. pretty much stayed to that trajectory. So those are kind of the uncomfortable things that don't get talked about much.
Come on, girl.
In your review in The New Yorker, you write about this book that it details the bad decisions that led Jackson to ruin and the increasingly foggy world from which he made them. Is that a reference to the drug abuse?
Absolutely. And I think there is this thing that even Sullivan can't really get to the bottom of mental illness. And it might have just been brought on by the drug use. But it just some of his activity suggests some sort of psychological trauma early on. I'm just an armchair psychologist here on this. But when you think about his weird sexual issues, his issues with destroying his own face, of not liking what he looked like and things like that. And the way it manifested itself, obviously, are bad decisions. The most comical thing in the book is just this array of advisors and managers and business advisors he brought on over the years, and they are just a real rogues gallery of some well-meaning but some utterly silly people. And of course, he'd fire them, which would set off a round of lawsuits. He had money problems late in his life, and he'd end up hiring these managers and borrowing millions of dollars from them and then firing them, and then they have to sue him. He went to Bahrain and was being kept by the sheik for 2 or 3 years and then left him, owing him $7 million. That produced another lawsuit. And you do this for 25 years, and all of a sudden, you've got 20 or 30 ongoing lawsuits. As I say in the piece, the Nation of Islam came in at one point. My favorite line in the entire book is he had a couple of German managers, and they were supplanted by these new Muslim Brotherhood people who wouldn't let Jackson talk to his managers anymore. And the German guy says, they were worse than Sony.
Which was his record label.
It's a great record industry line.
Now, you talk about this rogues gallery. It kind of starts with his own dad, doesn't it, with Joseph Jackson, a kind of violent, really kind of abusive father to Michael and to the other kids.
Right. He's a very interesting figure. There's really not enough written about him. One criticism I have of the book is that Sullivan doesn't talk about him at all. And I tried to read everything I could about Jackson. There are some interesting tidbits. Obviously, there's a lot on the record about the way he treated his kids. He's widely considered to be a buffoon in the record industry. Anyone who watched him after his son died getting in front of microphones and talking about his new record label and bringing on some crazy rap artist he was promoting sees what an embarrassing person he was. On the other hand, he was unquestionably a visionary. He produced, you know, one of the biggest pop acts of our time, and his daughter Janet as well, who was another one of the biggest pop acts of our time.
And took his kids out on the road and, you know, made a life for them outside the steel mill. And you know, success may not have been easy, but it came. It came pretty quick. 1969, the group's first number one hit was released, the Jackson 5 with I Want You Back. Jackson 5, Michael and the rest of the gang. I Want You Back from 1969. That was their first number one hit. We're speaking with Bill Wyman, the music journalist who reviewed the new biography of Michael Jackson by Randall Sullivan for The New Yorker. The biography is called Untouchable, The Strange Life and Tragic Death of Michael Jackson. You mentioned that one of your, you know, sort of minor criticisms of Sullivan's biography is he doesn't talk enough about the father. On the other hand, he does talk about Jackson and his mom and his mother's role, which I don't – maybe I'm wrong, but I haven't heard so much about her before.
Well, it's well known in the family. She's the heart of the family. All the kids are reputed to adore her. Jackson, of course, left – the only person in his family he left money to was his mom. He was allegedly always really close to his mom and things like that. It was a very odd dichotomy growing up between Joseph, who I think it's fair to say slept around a lot on the road. He had somewhere between several and many kids out of the marriage. Mm-hmm. And then the mother, who was this saintly Jehovah's Witness, didn't want to celebrate birthdays and such like that. So it was a very odd pairing. The key role she played during Jackson's lifetime was the family always viewed Michael Jackson as their meal ticket. So everything was about getting Michael to use his celebrity to support his brothers. Mm-hmm. So after his first couple adult solo records, he was sort of arm twisted into touring with his brothers instead of doing the solo tour, which he should have done on his own. Jackson himself didn't have the strength of character when it came to his family to say, look, I'm going out on tour. I'll give you guys 20 minutes in the middle of my show. You know, he couldn't bring himself to do that. It was always a Jackson 5 or the Jackson show. And according to all the biographies, his mother was the person who in the end the family would go to, and she'd call Michael up and sort of emotionally arm twist him into subordinating his own needs and future for that of the family. So I think she has also played a pretty bad role in his life and his decline. Since he died, he gave essentially half his estate to her, half his estate to his kids. So now all of a sudden she's sort of in control of his family, but Jackson also in control of his fortune, but Jackson didn't want her giving his money to his family. So now she's in the position of begging for money from the executors of the estate who are watching her like a hawk so that she's not always funneling the money to the rest of the family. So yeah. it's still a pernicious, really bad, emotionally fraught situation for the family.
So in 1975, Michael Jackson begins to try and carve out a solo career for himself, leaving Motown for CBS, which would later become Sony. But he still has to keep coming back to the family band. And in 1976, records with the Jacksons, no longer the Jackson 5, but the Jacksons, this album for CBS, including this song called Blues Away. Away is the name of that from the Jacksons' 1976 album. That song was written by Michael Jackson, but at the behest of his mom, coming back to the family band to play with his brothers, even as he was trying to make it as a solo artist. We're talking with Bill Wyman, the music journalist who reviewed for The New Yorker Randall Sullivan's new biography of Michael Jackson called Untouchable, The Strange Life and Tragic Death of Michael Jackson. What does Sullivan have to say about Jackson as a songwriter in these years, the mid to late 70s, early 80s, when he's really coming into his own as a soloist?
He tracks that really well, actually, and he notes that the songs in those albums, I think he also wrote Heartbreak Hotel, and he wrote one hit with his brother Randy, that kind of shows the origins of his songwriting, of his later songwriting prowess. But ironically, he actually doesn't talk in the book much about something that I don't think gets talked about enough at all, which is what a great songwriter Michael Jackson was. He wrote, as I think I say in the piece, he wrote that first hit single from Off the Wall, and he wrote the first hit single from Thriller, which was Billie Jean. He wrote Beat It. He wrote The Way You Make Me Feel. Of all those big famous songs of the era, I think the only one he didn't write is Man in the Mirror. I think he had 16 solo writing credit songs on his first four albums, and 12, maybe 13 were top 10 hits. Seven or eight were number one hits. I mean, the list of people in the world who've written eight number one hits is very, very small. Madonna, for example, has never written a number one hit on her own. So that, I think, is an extraordinary achievement of his, that when he needed a hit single to kickstart an album sale, he wrote himself. He wrote The Girl Is Mine with Paul McCartney, mm-hmm. and then he wrote Billie Jean, and they wrote Beat It. And it's an extraordinary – those are the songs that made Thriller the biggest selling record of all time, and he did it all by himself, which I think isn't quite, I mean, that's something that people can really talk about.
Right. And, you know, even before Thriller with Off the Wall, as you say, you know, Quincy Jones, the producer, is searching for songwriters. And there under his nose is Michael Jackson himself, who ends up writing the album's big hit, Don't Stop Till You Get Enough. Don't Stop Till You Get Enough. Michael Jackson wrote it, recorded it from the 1979 album Off the Wall. Bill Wyman reviewed the new biography of Michael Jackson for The New Yorker, written by Randall Sullivan. 1979, the year of Michael Jackson's first nose job. Sullivan does cover the various changes in Michael Jackson's appearance. Is there any new ground that he covers?
Well, I not really. It's a very good and good strong accounting of it. That the drug use, he really gets into it, finds out how it all happened, who did a lot of the surgeries. There is this kind of lingering question, though. What is it that wanted him, that made him basically obliterate his own face? It's one obvious theory that had something to do with race, that he didn't. You know, obviously he had all these excuses as to why he did it, but basically he tried to make himself look white. Some people say, look, that was his father's face he was trying to get away from. Virtually all the members of the family had nose jobs to make their face look different from Joseph's, and then he finally did as well. And then there is this kind of, you know, Jackson's sexuality is a very mysterious issue. One of the chilling parts in the book is when Sullivan basically says, look, I think he was sexless. He was pre-sexual. Mm-hmm. And that he might have died a virgin, which would be a very, very sad thing for a young boy, you know, growing up to never have experienced what we would call normal intimate relations. On the other hand, there's a lot of evidence that obviously based on these court, but based on the one court trial and other allegations, that he did have a thing for young boys. And I think that, you know, I mean, anyone can make their own decision up, but he certainly got himself into a lot of trouble based on that. And even if he didn't do anything that would be legally actionable, it was extraordinarily inappropriate, and it was damaging to the kids involved, and it displays a lot of psychological unhealth on Jackson's part. I think mm-hmm. we can all agree.
So that's Randall Sullivan covering that territory in the book Untouchable, The Strange Life and Tragic Death of Michael Jackson. Bill Wyman reviewed it pretty favorably for The New Yorker. But at the end of the day, Bill, is there what's still out there to learn about Michael Jackson?
I think it's really interesting to compare him to Elvis or the Beatles. Jackson was obsessed with being popular, so he did whatever he could to kind of get himself into the center of the culture at that moment, in which he was very successful at. Elvis is kind of interesting. I think you can make the argument that Elvis brought the culture to himself. People who bought Elvis records had never really bought a record like that before. People who bought Beatles records, they were doing something new.
Right.
Whereas Jackson was a very big star in 1981. He'd been a star for 12 years. He was a household name. He was incredibly gorgeous. He had the biggest record label in the world behind him. He had a great producer. Putting together the biggest selling record of all time isn't that hard from that position, though it's still an achievement. Doing what Elvis did, which is coming from, you know, not quite overnight, but very quickly from living in a shotgun shack to changing an entire culture, I think is of a different nature of celebrity and artistic achievement. Whether Jackson will survive as an artistic Titan, I think, remains to be seen.
Well, the whole legacy question, that's a book for further down the road. But for the moment, Bill Wyman's been reviewing Randall Sullivan's new biography of Michael Jackson called Untouchable. And Bill, thanks so much for joining us again.
John, I appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
This is Soundcheck. Join us online at 2 p.m. tomorrow for a performance by Omar Sosa. The Cuban-born jazz pianist returns to our studio with a new album inspired by the Miles Davis classic, Kind of Blue. And Omar will perform live at our piano. You can hear it tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern on soundcheck.org. Coming up, musician Sean Lennon has joined forces with Greg Saunier, who you may know as the drummer from the band Deerhoof. They've got a new improvisational duo called Mystical Weapons, and they'll play live next. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. When a band releases an album, you might expect to hear them playing those songs when you see them live. That generally seems to be how bands do it. But when it comes to the new group called Mystical Weapons, it's pretty unlikely that you'll ever hear them play the same thing twice. That's because this duo, made up of musician and composer Sean Lennon and Deerhoof's drummer Greg Saunier, improvise all of their music. They just released a self-titled album, Mystical Weapons, and they're joining me here in the studio. Sean, good to see you again.
Hey, how you doing?
Greg, welcome to Soundcheck. Good to have you here.
Hi, John.
Now, the track we were just hearing, Colony Collapse Disorder, that's from the record.
Yeah.
If we had said to you, would you guys please play Colony Collapse Disorder here in the studio, would you?
Well,
could
the fact
you?
That I just heard a snippet of it would help. I can probably imitate that. Yeah, and that one's actually quite simple. I remember
you
that
think
one.
It was simple. I played that main guitar riff. It was hard, right?
I meant
now it's
for
a finger
me.
Breaker.
I meant for my part. But I remember recording that a little bit, and I remember the setup, and it's modular, that one. It stays in one
yeah,
scale.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I think on that one, but not on all of them. Like, for instance, there's a song called Dirty... And Dirty
Piece of cake, Sean.
That Greg improvised on the piano. I don't know if I could. I certainly couldn't comp his chords. I don't know if you could.
How did this begin as, how did the two of you first come together and begin improvising as opposed to, like, sitting down, writing songs and doing the usual thing?
Well, we were playing a gig in San Francisco, my band The Ghost and another band called If By Yes with Yuka Honda. And that club needed another band, and we kind of were planning on just having our gear there, so we didn't want to bring in a band we didn't know. And Greg and my mother and I had just played, Deerhoof had played with the Yoko Ono Plastic Ono band in Oakland, so it just, Yuka actually suggested, why don't you and Greg improvise? And I was a big fan of Greg's playing, so we tried it, and it turned out to be really fun.
Now, that I will not be the only person flashing back to the scene in Spinal Tap where they resort to the jazz odyssey,
That's my favorite. This, like, ooh, Derek Smalls.
Cancel this session immediately.
He wrote this. This is his song. He goes, dun, 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 dun. It's really great, actually. I love that when he's like, when the keyboardist is like, well, I can play Nigel's bass line. I've got two hands. Right? That's really
yeah,
good.
Yeah, but it was Puppet Show in Spinal Tap. If I told him once, I told him a thousand times.
But see, here's the thing.
The
Spinal Tap free jazz improv thing goes on forever. Whereas this record, these pieces
are concise.
They really
are. Thanks
it's like
to editing.
Little moments. So what's about to happen here in the studio? Do you know?
No one knows, unfortunately. But we're just going to go for it and have fun.
All right.
See what happens.
Concision. Well,
you've had to make some decisions. You're surrounded by instruments.
Made a concision decision.
Well, yeah, what I'm doing now is I have this, what I just figured out for my part is that I have this foot synth controller, which has solved a lot of issues for me. Because I used to try to loop bass lines with a pedal and then run over to the guitar and play along to it. And Greg would have to play to these randomly badly looped bass lines, which was really hard. Mm-hmm. So now I can sort of control the bass with my feet while I play guitar, which is helping a lot.
All right. So Sean Lennon's got the 12-string electric guitar. Greg Saunier's got our drum kit there in the corner. Let's hear a live improvisation from Mystical Weapons here in the Soundcheck studio. We'll be right back. Well, that is Mystical Weapons live here in the Soundcheck studio. That's Sean Lennon playing guitars, plural. He switched from in the middle from one to the other. Greg Saunier behind our drum kit here in the studio. This is normally the point, guys, where I would say that song is called blah, whatever.
That's a good
actually,
name.
Actually, no. Blah.
It's called A16 Avion. What is this? That's what your mixers are called.
So we're naming it A16 Avion.
Well, I mean, we have to have a powwow about that.
There's no time for no powwow.
Okay, well, let's think on our feet then. What do you want to call it?
Somewhere between Star Wars and High School.
I like that.
Thank you.
It's one of our shorter titles.
Somewhere between Star Wars and High School. It sounds like there is a story there, Greg, that I probably am not going to want to hear. The band is Mystical Weapons. Their album is also called Mystical Weapons. There is, in addition to the two of you who are here with us today, a third kind of member. You work with the visual artist Martha Coburn. How does she, I mean, is she improvising visual imagery while you guys are doing
against
this?
Her will. Martha Coburn, she's a filmmaker who mm-hmm. makes actual titled, finished animation films.
One of which, Greg, you scored at least
one?
Yeah,
one called Dolls vs. Dictators mm-hmm. that premiered at the Museum of the Moving Image, which is in Queens for some grand reopening. Yeah, you got it.
She's really an amazing artist, and we're kind of blessed to have her. And we feel at this point that our shows, you know, our live shows, she's an essential part of them because she's done a lot of different things with us. She's done live puppets. She's done live film editing.
She has many clips from many of her different films loaded into this machine. She can call them up at any moment.
Right.
So when she hears us go into the really evil stuff, you know, the skeletons start dancing and I can't actually see any of it. When I say that I like it, that's just a complete lie. I'm facing the other direction.
But we can get you a mirror on your kick drum. You
know,
then you can sort of check yourself out and the visuals at the same time.
You know, there is a whole new wave of younger musicians who are doing live film scores, especially to old silent films. And that's I mean, Sean, I don't know if you were joking or not, but that's often the way it's done is a mirror or a laptop in front of the musician so that you can see what's going on the screen behind you. The band is here in the studio. Sean Lennon, Greg Saunier, they are Mystical Weapons. And shall we hear another piece? You want to make something else up on the spot for us?
Let's do it.
All right. It's Mystical Weapons live on Soundcheck. It's another live, improvised performance from the band Mystical Weapons, made up of Sean Lennon and Deerhoof drummer Greg Saunier. You can listen to an extended version of their performance at soundcheck.org. On tomorrow's show, legendary singer Aaron Neville revisits the doo-wop songs of his youth on a new collection called My True Story. He joins us in the studio to perform classic songs like This Magic Moment and Work With Me, Annie. and we'll hear about his recent decision to leave his longtime family band, the Neville Brothers. Plus, a new book details the dramatic story of singer Mary Wells. The one-time queen of Motown scored multiple hits for the legendary record label in its early days, but she left it behind when she was just 21. That story coming up tomorrow on Soundcheck. That's going to do it for today. See you back here tomorrow at 9. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.